Welcome to this deep dive. In this lesson, we're exploring data sources, primary, secondary, and digital sources. If you've watched the overview, this will build on that. If not, you'll still be able to follow along. Now, let's go further by exploring practical examples, future workplace relevance, responsible use, and how you can build confidence with this skill.
You know, it's funny. Most professionals, they really think they're making decisions based on solid facts. Like absolute objective truths.
Right, because nobody wants to think they're just guessing.
Exactly. But when you look closely at the landscape of modern business, an alarming percentage of strategic decisions are built on data that is, well, entirely taken out of context.
Or
it's heavily biased.
Or just completely expired. Right?
Oh, absolutely expired. And honestly, the ability to rapidly assess the accuracy of the information right in front of you, it's basically survival gear for the modern workplace.
Yeah, I mean, I think about gathering data the exact same way you would think about building a house.
Oh, that's a good way to look at it.
Right, because if you build your arguments, you know, your walls, on a shaky foundation of unverified weak data, the whole structure might actually look perfectly fine for a minute.
Yeah, from the outside.
Exactly. You can paint it. You can make it look like a highly polished slide deck. But the second it comes under scrutiny, the second a stakeholder or a client leans on that wall and asks a probing question,
it just completely falls apart.
The whole thing collapses.
Yeah.
Whereas if you use verified, credible data, that acts as solid bedrock.
And the scary thing is when you build on that weak foundation, the collapse isn't usually immediate. It happens, you know, months later.
Like during a major project review.
Yeah, or after a product launch totally fails. And then someone finally tracks that bad decision back to a flawed statistic that nobody even bothered to verify in the first place.
Wow. Yeah, that's a nightmare scenario.
It really is. And that ability to pour a solid foundation, that is exactly what separates a novice from a trusted, high-level professional.
Because it's easy to just find a number, right?
Exactly. Anyone with an internet connection can do a quick search and find a number that, you know, supports their gut feeling.
Yeah.
But the capacity to rapidly filter out the noise and find the structural truth, that is a premium skill.
So to build that solid foundation, we first need to understand the different raw materials at our disposal. We are looking at three main categories here.
Right.
Primary data, secondary data, and digital sources. Let's break down the mechanics of these, starting with primary data. I mean, this is your raw, original material.
Yeah, the defining characteristic of primary data is that it is collected directly for a specific purpose. You are generating new information that didn't exist before you asked the question.
So you're going straight to the source.
Exactly. So say you are a junior analyst, right? And you're trying to understand why users are abandoning a shopping cart on your company's app.
Okay.
If you set up a controlled A/B test, or you conduct one-on-one user interviews, you are generating primary data. You control the methodology.
You know exactly how the questions were asked, who was asked, and under what conditions.
Yes, which makes it incredibly valuable.
But also, I imagine, highly resource intensive. I mean, it takes significant time and budget to run a proper survey or a clinical trial.
Oh, huge amounts of time, which is why we rely so heavily on the second category, which is secondary data.
Right. So this is existing data collected by someone else. You're analyzing information that has already been processed or gathered for another purpose entirely.
Yeah, and it is highly efficient because you are leveraging the heavy lifting that another researcher or an entire organization has already done.
Like industry reports or government census data.
Exactly. Or published academic articles. Instead of, you know, surveying 10,000 people yourself, you just download a report from a major research firm that already did it.
But the trade-off there has to be control, right? Because you didn't design the survey. You didn't select the participants.
That's the catch. You have to trust the person who did the original digging. You inherit their methodology.
And more importantly, you inherit their potential blind spots.
You inherit everything. If their sample size is too small, or if their questions were leading, those flaws are now just baked right into your secondary data.
Wow. Which is why evaluating the source becomes an entirely critical step.
It's the most important step.
And this brings us to the third category, which frankly feels like the environment we all just live and breathe in now. Digital data sources.
Yes, the big one.
This includes websites, social media, digital platforms, online databases. But, you know, I want to push back on treating this as a distinct category.
Hey, let's hear it.
Well, if digital data includes things like social media and websites, aren't those mostly just regurgitated secondary sources or even rumor-based? How do we categorize a tweet versus, say, a highly rigorous online academic database?
That is a fantastic point, and it's exactly why digital data as a category completely blurs the traditional lines between primary and secondary sources.
Because it's all just on a screen.
Exactly. The medium itself, the internet, it no longer decides the reliability. The screen you are looking at is just a delivery vehicle.
So a digital source could be either primary or secondary, depending entirely on how you use it.
Exactly. Let's take your example of a social media post, like a tweet.
Okay.
If you are a marketer studying online consumer sentiment around a new product launch, and you use a software tool to scrape, you know, tens of thousands of tweets to analyze the raw emotional reaction of the public,
then those tweets are your primary data.
Right. Because you are directly observing the raw behavior of a population.
The tweet itself is the raw material in that context. You are studying the artifact.
Yes. But if that same tweet is written by an influencer making a bold, generalized claim about a new medical study they supposedly read.
Oh, I see where this is going.
Yeah, and you use their tweet as evidence in a health report, you're now treating it as secondary data.
And in that case, it is incredibly unreliable secondary data because it completely lacks the rigor, methodology, and verification of a peer-reviewed article.
Exactly. So the blurring of these lines in the digital space means we just cannot trust a source simply because it looks polished on a screen.
So because those lines are so blurred today, how do you actually verify what you are looking at? Like, what are the actual mechanics of doing a credibility check?
Well, the first and most critical mechanism is checking exactly who collected the data.
Okay, trace it back.
Trace it back to its origin. What are their credentials? Do they have a vested interest or a bias in the outcome?
I imagine this means going way beyond the About Us page on a website. I mean, if I'm looking at a slick industry report published by a think tank, I should probably be looking for their funding declarations, right? Or tracing who their parent company is.
Oh, absolutely.
Like if an organization publishes a study saying that a certain chemical is perfectly safe and you dig into the footnotes and realize they are funded by the industry that manufactures that chemical.
It changes everything. It changes the entire lens through which you view the data.
That makes total sense.
Another major red flag is methodological transparency. If a source gives you a sweeping statistic but refuses to publish how they arrived at that number.
Like no sample size, no margin of error.
Right. No survey questions provided. You just cannot trust that data. They are asking for blind faith, not peer review.
Okay. So track the origin, look for funding, demand methodological transparency. What about the time frame? Because checking publication dates seems like such a basic step, but how often does slightly outdated information completely derail a project or a professional decision?
Honestly, constantly.
Wait, really?
Oh, yeah. Let's talk about the half-life of knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
In certain fields, particularly technology, software development, or cutting-edge medicine, the body of accepted knowledge overturns rapidly.
Right. Things change overnight.
So a statistic about consumer digital spending habits from just a few years ago, say, right before a major global economic shift, that might lead a company to totally inaccurate conclusions today.
Wow.
You might convince your executive team to launch a multi-million dollar product based on a trend that literally died 3 years ago, all because you didn't check the timestamp on your secondary data.
So an expired data point is kind of like expired milk. Like, it might look perfectly fine while it's sitting in the carton, but if you pour it into the recipe, it ruins the entire dish.
That is a perfect analogy. And what happens when you use expired ingredients?
Yeah.
You spend a lot of time trying to cover up the bad taste with heavy spices.
Oh, man. Yeah.
In a professional setting, if you rely on bad data, you end up spending hours writing convoluted slides and complex twisting arguments to try and make that bad data sound logical to your boss.
When really, if the foundation is solid, the argument writes itself.
Precisely. Which means you also need to compare multiple sources to spot inconsistencies. If one blog says a market is worth $10 billion and a government database says it's worth $50 billion.
Someone's methodology is deeply flawed.
Right. So let's look at how these verification strategies actually play out when the pressure's on in a real-world environment.
Okay, I love practical scenarios.
Let's consider a scenario that happens every single day in entry-level corporate jobs. You have a junior analyst tasked with pulling together a market sizing report for a major client meeting.
And they are probably under a serious time crunch.
Oh, the meeting is tomorrow morning. The pressure is completely on.
Right, so what do they do?
Under that pressure, they do what is most natural. They just type the query into a search engine and grab whatever information pops up first.
Yeah, the path of least resistance.
Exactly. They pull numbers from heavily search engine optimized opinion blogs. They find an outdated PR website. And maybe they grab a few random social media claims because they look like visually appealing charts.
I mean, to be fair, in that moment, I would probably think I was being highly efficient. Like, I got the numbers in 10 minutes.
Sure, it feels efficient.
Yeah.
But when they sit down to synthesize the report, the numbers don't align. The arguments are weak. The data actually contradicts itself.
Because the market size varies wildly from source to source.
Yes, because PR blogs often inflate numbers to make their industry look better. The foundation is shaking before the client even walks into the room.
Yikes. So what's the pivot? How do they rescue this?
They have to make a deliberate pivot away from the open web. They stop relying on quick, unreliable digital sources, and they replace those weak links with premium tools.
Like verified academic databases.
Exactly. They pull demographic data directly from official government census bureaus, and they look at SEC filings from publicly traded companies.
It's exactly like upgrading your ingredients from the discount bin at a convenience store to a premium farmer's market. You're cooking the exact same recipe, but the final dish, or in this case, your final decision, is undeniably better.
And much more impressive to your stakeholders. The effort it takes to navigate to those premium tools pays off immensely in the end product.
So for this analyst, making that switch means their research credibility basically skyrockets.
Yes. Their arguments go from being easily dismissible to being airtight. In a workplace setting, that is the literal difference between your proposal getting rejected and your proposal getting funded.
But using premium ingredients isn't just about making yourself look good or getting a project funded right. We need to talk about the deeper responsibility you have to the people consuming your work.
It is a massive responsibility.
When we talk about poor source evaluation leading to poor decisions, those decisions have a real blast radius.
They do. We operate in a highly interconnected information ecosystem. Weak source evaluation leads directly to the spread of misinformation, unreliable research, and ultimately real-world harm.
When you say real-world harm, I mean, it sounds intense, but it's fundamentally true.
It really is.
If you're an analyst using bad data to design a public policy, or you are modeling a medical intervention, or even just building a company's financial strategy, people's lives, their jobs, and their livelihoods are directly affected by your math.
Absolutely. Responsible professional behavior means recognizing your role in that ecosystem. When you take a piece of data, put it into a chart, and drop it into your presentation, you are putting your professional stamp of approval on it.
You're saying, I vouch for this.
Yes. You are telling your colleagues, I vouch for this. Spreading unverified data, even accidentally, fundamentally damages your trustworthiness.
Okay, I have to ask though, is it really our responsibility if the source itself lied to us or presented itself as credible?
That's a common question.
Because if I find a report that looks highly professional, it has great graphic design, but the authors literally faked the underlying data, am I on the hook for that when I present it?
It is a tough reality of professional life, but yes, you are. In a professional setting, the onus of evidence-based reasoning and verification always falls on the person presenting the data.
So I'm not just passing it along.
No, you aren't just a conduit passing information along. You are a filter.
So I can't just throw my hands up and say, hey, don't look at me. The blog said it was true.
Not if you want to be treated as a trusted professional.
Yeah.
If you didn't do your due diligence to check who funded the data, compare multiple sources, and look for those methodological red flags we discussed, then you bear responsibility for passing that bad data into the decision-making stream.
You are the final line of defense before that data turns into action.
Well said.
So, if the responsibility is completely on us, how do we build the muscle memory to evaluate sources quickly and efficiently? Because, to be honest, the reality is nobody has 5 hours to verify a single statistic when they have a dozen reports due.
Right, that's just not realistic.
I imagine it's about setting up your toolkit in advance so you aren't hunting for the right database at the 11th hour.
That is exactly it.
Yeah.
Front-loading the effort is the entire secret. The key is familiarizing yourself with reliable digital tools ahead of time. They're incredibly practical, highly rigorous digital tools that are essentially gold standards for reliable secondary data.
We're talking about tools like Google Scholar, Statista, and Our World in Data. I have to say, I'm a massive fan of Our World in
Oh,
Data.
it's brilliant.
The way they visualize massive global data sets, but also transparently link every single data point back to its rigorous original methodology is incredible.
It is a masterclass in transparency. And with tools like Google Scholar, you aren't just searching for articles. You can actually use citation counts as a proxy indicator for reliability.
Oh, that's a smart trick.
Yeah, if a paper has been cited 2,000 times by other researchers, it has survived a significant amount of peer scrutiny. And Statista is fantastic because it aggregates data from thousands of institutes and directly links you to the primary source for verification.
But for a young professional working a fast-paced job, how can they realistically make time to use these academic-level tools without feeling like they're slowing down their workflow?
Well, yes, the first few times you navigate Google Scholar or try to parse the methodology tab on Statista, it might take a few minutes longer than a standard open web search. But what you are doing is building digital adaptability.
It's an investment.
Exactly. Once you understand the architecture of these databases, they actually massively speed up your workflow. You aren't wasting 45 minutes wading through pages of unreliable clickbait trying to find a real number. You go straight to the trusted source.
It's like knowing exactly which aisle the premium ingredients are in at the store. You don't have to wander around reading every label. You walk in, grab the highest quality item, and leave.
And beyond just the search tools, there are incredible open access educational resources available that can teach you proper research design from the ground up.
Right, universities put out a lot of good stuff.
The resources provided by MIT Libraries, Harvard Library Research Guides, and Stanford Library Resources are absolute gold mines. They are freely available, and they outline exactly how to structure an inquiry, how to spot bias, and how to evaluate a source mathematically.
So the tools and the guides are out there, waiting to be used. Which brings us to a practical activity for you, the listener. We want to challenge you to put this into practice today. Find one primary data source, one secondary data source, and one digital data source.
Just one of each.
Yep. And once you have them, actively evaluate their credibility using the mechanics we talked about. Look for the funding source, check the publication date, dig into their methodology, and try to compare the claim against another independent source.
It might seem like a small exercise, but integrating these specific tools and these quick credibility checks into your daily routine is exactly how you build long-term digital adaptability and confidence.
It becomes second nature.
Right. When verification becomes muscle memory, you stop feeling overwhelmed by the sheer volume of information out there, and you start feeling empowered to navigate it.
And that empowerment is what this is all about, being the person in the room who brings the solid bedrock, not the shaky foundation. So, as we wrap up, we want to leave you with a final reflection prompt to mull over as you go about your rake. Ask yourself, how can I improve the way I evaluate and choose data sources?
It is a question you should be asking yourself continuously throughout your career. Mastering this doesn't just make you better at your current job, it ensures lifelong learning and guarantees that you remain a trustworthy, evidence-based voice in whatever professional room you enter.
We want to encourage you to stay curious, stay responsible, and stay future ready. Make sure to review the end of module study guide and complete the workbook activities to really lock this knowledge in.
And if you want to explore the mechanics of this further, the curriculum references some essential reading on this topic. Specifically, the titles The Craft of Research, Factfulness, and Research Design. They are highly recommended for understanding how to interact with data responsibly and rigorously.
Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Remember, the next time you are preparing a report, an argument, or a major project, think about the house you are building. Don't settle for a shaky foundation of unverified internet rumors just because they are easy to find. Take the extra 5 minutes, grab the premium ingredients, and build your decisions on bedrock. We'll catch you next time.